you to talk about a chant this morning. It's called the Enme Juko Kanangyo, which translates to the 10-line Beginningless and Endless Compassion Sutra. But I want to start with a poem by a guy named Terence Keenan. He's a Zen priest. I just ran across this poem. It goes, "It is not for understanding nor clarity of meaning that I listen carefully to you, late thrush across the meadows." One more time. "It is not for understanding nor clarity of meaning that I listen carefully to you, late thrush across the meadows." So when I read that, I got a real mental picture of the road, actually, on the way down to Hokioji and seeing this bird across the road. And hearing the call of that bird. And, you know, we all know what this is like. You hear the call of the bird, and you just stop and listen to the call of the bird. You know, it doesn't make sense. So what's he trying to tell me there? You know, could you make that your point a little clearer, Mr. Thrush? You know, it just stops us, and we just listen to the call of the bird. And there's a sort of pure moment of just paying attention. And then we think, what kind of bird is that anyway? Is that a meadowlark? No, I think it's a thrush. Is it a chickadee? What is it? Is it like thrush mating season? What's going, you know, what's the deal with the thrush? And then maybe, oh yeah, you hear it again, and then you kind of come back to the sound of a thrush. And you're just there listening to it. And then our mind kind of takes off again and goes off on some kind of thinking. So we're so used to that kind of thinky kind of mind that when we have that opportunity to just listen to something like the call of the thrush, the call of the bird, it's kind of a wonderful, pure moment. It's a wonderful, pure moment. But, you know, the mind that's doing the, what kind of bird is that? Is that a thrush? What is it? It's the same mind that's just there with the bird. They're the same thing. They seem really different. Oh, now I'm off on my thinking routine, but now I'm really listening to this bird because I'm so Zen. But they're both the same thing. They're both the same thing. And so this poem, the listening to the thrush, listening to the bird song, it's a little bit of a clue to unlocking this sutra. I learned this sutra, this little chant, about 12 years ago, and I learned it in English. In a different translation than the one I put on the bulletin today. I learned it in English, but it may as well have been in Sanskrit because it just didn't make any sense at all to me. I had no idea what I was chanting. And then later on, I learned it in Sino-Japanese, and I decided to memorize it And when I did that, I did it without any expectation of understanding it or finding some kind of clarity from doing that. All I knew from the English and from the Sino-Japanese, all I knew was that the canon and the title is the Bodhisattva of Compassion. So I knew that the chant had something to do with developing compassion. And I didn't really think about it beyond that as I was learning it in Sino-Japanese. So, but the wonderful thing about chanting in a foreign language is that you don't get caught up in those words, right? When we sew raksus, this little version of the Buddha's robe that we sew, and when we sew them ourselves, and with every stitch we chant, "I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Sangha," so it's a meditation. We're staying right there. But when I do it when I do it, I chant to myself. I chant it in Japanese instead, Namukie Butsu, because I find that if I start chanting, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, in English, that my mind just goes off somewhere. I take refuge. That's kind of like being in a cave. I would like to go, you know, blah, 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 blah. You go off. And you know, and there you are. You're gone. So there's something that I like about chanting in a different language. And yet, recently I ran across a couple of literal word-by-word translations of this chant with commentaries. And so I'd like to walk through that with you this morning. The canon and the title is also known as Kanzeon, or you might know her as Kuan Yin or Avalokiteshvara. And she's a bodhisattva, or an archetypal figure personifying compassion. And she's been described, I brought along a statue of her just so you could see what the imagery looks like. And she is sort of the counterpoint and a complementary figure to Manjushri, who's the bodhisattva that we have on our altar. He's the bodhisattva of wisdom. She's the bodhisattva of compassion. So he sort of is a representation of what wisdom would look like inside of each one of us. And she represents compassion. And this statue of her, I brought, this is on my home altar. This is the position that she's in is called the position of royal ease. And I'm going to talk about that later. So she's sitting, she's got one knee up like this, and she's sitting in royal ease. If you look around, Zenthin, you walk around, there's a whole lot of Avalokiteshvaras around. There's one out in the yard. There's a couple of them downstairs. There's one on the third floor altar. They're kind of all over the place around here. So the chant. From what I understand, it's a popular chant in Asian countries, in different forms of Buddhism in Asia. And it's also pretty well known here in the West, in Buddhist circles anyway. So here it is in Sino-Japanese. It goes, Kanzeon namu butsuyo butsu'u inyo butsu'u en buposo en jo rakugajo chonen kanzeon bonen kanzeon nennen jushin ki nennen furishin. And it's often chanted 9 times. When it's chanted in a group, it's often chanted 9 times, and each time it's chanted, they go a little bit faster and faster and faster and faster. And so by the end, it's Kanzeyan Namu Butsuyo Butsu Inyo Butsu Enyo. And it's really quite something. The other way that sometimes it's chanted is with a mala, chanting it 108 times. So you take one of these malas like this, and with each time you chant it, you move one of the beads, right? And so you chant it 108 times. It takes about half an hour. It takes about half an hour. So that's kind of an interesting practice to do, too. So it's a practice. It's a practice that sometimes people take up for developing compassion, for developing the practice of compassion. And the title of it, 10-Line Beginningless and Endless Compassion Sutra, it's just a real straightforward description of what it is. It's 10 lines long, and it's a sutra that outlines what it would look like to live a life of compassion, what that looks like, how you would go about developing compassion in your life. So sometimes it's chanted not by people who are so compassionate, but by people who aren't so compassionate, so they can develop it. I read a story about John Lennon one time, a long time ago, in which he said the reason that he was always talking about peace and developing peace was that he didn't feel like a real peaceful guy. You know, he said he was, when he was a young man, he was real violent and real angry. And that's why he talked about peace, because he was trying to develop that in himself. So it's the same thing with this. It's something that you use to try to arouse that compassion within yourself. So the first line of it, kanzeon, means absorbing the sounds of the world. And that is the translation for the name Avalokiteshvara, or kanzeon. And it means absorbing the cries of the world, or hearing the cries of the world, absorbing the sounds of the world. And, you know, sometimes those sounds are those beautiful bird songs. And we're out somewhere, and we hear that sound, and we just bring it in. And other times it's the sound of other people's suffering, or their hopelessness, or their pain, or they're just needing to be heard. And we hear those songs, and or those sounds, or those songs, and it just kind of cracks open our heart. It cracks open our heart. And this particular bodhisattva, one of the things that she's known for is she hears the sounds of the world, and she just immediately acts to do something to help. You know, she doesn't stop and think about, well, how did they get into this mess to begin with? You know, did they do something to kind of bring it on? Or maybe I should work on the socio-political situation to help this person out. This bodhisattva just acts, you know. If you burn one hand, the other hand just immediately goes to comfort it. It's that kind of not thinking, just acting kind of response to someone's pain. So absorbing the sounds of the world awakens a Buddha right here is the second line. And, you know, as I think this is part of becoming an adult, or at least this is one way that we know that we have become an adult, is when we have gone through some kind of experience of great loss or great pain. And what happens is that going through one or two of those kind of experiences of big loss or big suffering in our own lives really wakes us up to noticing other people's suffering and feeling compassion for that. You notice this, I think in particular, right after somebody's died. You know, you are missing that person and you're feeling grief, but you're also noticing everywhere around. You know, you're in that kind of special, kind of liminal sort of place right after somebody's died, where you're real open to all the suffering of the world. And when that happens, it awakens the Buddha right here. This Buddha, the one who's sitting on this cushion. You know. Who, me? Yes, you. It's this Buddha right here that gets awakened by that. And after that happens, you know, after we've been through a couple of those experiences, we meet someone and we know that they're suffering, and we understand what suffering feels like, and so we feel compassion based on that, not based on their personal situation. So, you know, I know what suffering feels like. I don't know what particular thing you're going through right now, but I know what it feels like to be in that kind of pain. And so you respond to that, right? A literal translation of this line is something like homage to Buddha or praise to Buddha or at one with Buddha. At one with Buddha. And you know, I mean, noticing suffering and trying to alleviate it is probably the best homage that you can pay to Buddha, right? So these two lines, absorbing the sounds of the world and awakening a Buddha right here, are the two lines of the chant that describe the person's aspiration. This is what we want to do. We want to notice suffering in the world. We want to be open to noticing it. We want to be able to be moved by it, and we want to help. The next two lines, Yobutsu U-in and Yobutsu U-en, mean all are one with Buddha, all awake to Buddha. And these two lines talk about having the capacity to awaken and live our lives as a Buddha. So in the first line, the word in has the connotation of direct or direct cause. And the second line, the word en, has the connotation of indirect. And here, the in, you can think of it like a seed or the egg of the bird. So the direct cause, the in, is the egg. You've got this egg, and it is what's going to turn into a bird. It's got everything in it right now to become that bird. It is a bird, right? It's the egg. It's got all the genetic material. It's got everything it needs. And the N, the indirect cause, is the time that it takes, that it needs time. It needs the warmth of the parent's body sitting on the nest. You know, and when the time comes and it's pecking on the inside, it needs the parent pecking on the outside. So the N is the thing that brings it forth. So the first line is all are one with Buddha. That's the egg that already is one with what it aspires to be, you could say. And all awake to Buddha is that it takes something to awaken it. It's right here now, and it takes something to awaken. What's that Suzuki Roshi line? You're perfect just the way you are, and you could use a little help. that's what the chant is saying in those two lines. The next line is supported by Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So these are the three treasures. And Bupo So-en. And the N at the end of that line is that same indirect cause. So it's being supported by Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, being supported by the teacher and the teachings and the Sangha. And it's that which brings it forth. So if you want to develop something, you watch who you're learning from. You watch... You know, you're careful about what teachings you study. You're careful about who you hang around with, who you practice with, right? So, you know, if we have an aspiration for compassion, if we want to turn our lives in that direction, we can draw support and inspiration from Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So supported by Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure, right? And we've all had those kind of moments, I think, like when we hear the bird and we just stop and hear the bird. And sometimes, you know, when that happens, everything kind of stops. You know this feeling? Everything kind of stops, and the world looks sort of more amazing all of a sudden, and we aren't thinking about anything else. It's a very pure kind of moment. Sometimes that happens in retreat. Sometimes, a lot of times, people report that happening when they're out in nature. But when that happens, we aren't looking inward. You know, we're just listening to the bird. There isn't any sense of, this is me here listening to the bird. It's just the sound of the bird and me, and there isn't a real separation there. So it isn't self-reverential kind of thing. Almost all the translations use these exact words, and the first one, eternal, is kind of an odd word for to find in a Buddhist sutra, because that's something that we kind of don't ever talk about eternal. We talk about everything changing all the time in every moment. So, you know, so what's this eternal about? In this context, it's about, you can think of it as constancy or timelessness or beginninglessness and endlessness. You know, it's not our usual idea of eternal and nothing's going to change. And for joyous and selfless, you could take a look at the statue of Avalokiteshvara. She's sitting there in the royal ease position. And as she's sitting there, she's just completely at ease in her body and in her mind. And she's completely at ease with... I did that sort of without thinking. Honest. So she's completely at ease with the way that things are right now. Right now. And... This is a really important point about compassion, is that there's joy in it. You know, I think we sort of worry sometimes that if I open my heart to all the suffering and the pain of the world, that it's going to be overwhelming and it's going to really bum me out, man. But the idea is to enter it with that joyful kind of at easeness, to bring that kind of attitude toward it, And the other thing is that that our attention isn't self. It's focused outward. It isn't focused inward. She's not thinking about being the bodhisattva of compassion at the moment. She's just there being with. So eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. And the last word, this word pure, it can be kind of a charged word for some of us. I think especially for women, you know, keep yourself pure. I was on the bus last night, and I'd been thinking about this chant and this stuff, and it was getting near the end of the line, and there were two young guys sitting right behind me, and they were just talking, and they were having this conversation, and it was this very strange thing. It went right very gradually from having a conversation into, I realized that they were reciting something, and they were reciting it back and forth. And I don't know if it was a poem or a song or what, but it was the most violent, awful. It had like every awful thing you can imagine in it. There was this one line that went, and then it went pop, 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 and they were talking about the sign, you know, the sounds of a gun. You know, there was another line that's, I'm all about the cash. And, you know, it was, you know, they'd been having this conversation, and then they went, and it went on. It was like seven or eight blocks. They were sort of reciting this thing back and forth to each other, and they both knew all the words by heart. You know, and I'd been just spending a whole lot of time thinking about this chant for compassion. And, you know, I'm sitting there on the bus, and I'm listening to this. They're right in the seat behind me, and. You know, part of me is kind of appalled by it, and part of me, I mean, my heart just went out to these guys. I wanted to turn around and say, I have another poem you guys can chant. Let me teach you this one. If I had really been, you know, Avalokiteshvara, I would have just done it, but and it was my bus stop, so I didn't. But anyway, the point of that is that when you're bringing in that kind of stuff into your mind, that's sort of the opposite of purity of mind. You know, it's the opposite of purity of mind. I went to the movies with my brother a couple weeks ago, and we saw The Hobbit. And there were about 5 previews, and every single one of them was full of violence. It was even a cartoon movie, and it was full of violence. A couple of them were about the apocalypse. One of them had zombies. Every single one of them. And, you know, whenever I see those kind of previews, I want to go jump up on the stage and say, don't bring this stuff into your mind stream, people. You know, don't do that. So I don't. But there's something about what you bring into your mind stream. You know, what are you cultivating in your mind? Are you cultivating purity? Or are you cultivating a mind that's full of horrifying images? It makes a difference. So with those guys on the bus, I wanted to form a little sangha right there. So these 2 lines, supported by Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, our true nature is eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. So supported by the teaching, the teachers, and the community, we can call to mind the sort of place of timelessness, a place of selflessness, a place of purity, a place of happiness that doesn't have anything to do with that small sort of me, grasping kind of mind. Chonen Kanzeon, Bonen Kanzeon, through the day, great compassion, through the night, great compassion. I think, to me, these 2 lines are the core of the actual practice of what a person who takes up working with this chant is doing. This is the core of it. Because the idea is, if you're going to develop compassion in your life, you want it to become a habit. You want it to become sort of the natural go-to place in your life, your natural reaction. So through the day, Kanzeon, through the night, Kanzeon, it means from morning until night, you kind of keep this uppermost in your mind. You keep it somewhere in your mind. And I talked the year before, I talked about a teacher that I went to see one time who had taken up the practice of noticing impermanence. It was a Buddhist practice. She wanted to really understand impermanence. So for about a year, everywhere she went, she just looked, she noticed impermanence. So if she was driving and she noticed some roadkill, she said, there'd be a little sort of mental gusho, you know, to this life that has ended. The room that she was speaking in when I saw her was one of these old warehouses with exposed brick walls. And she said, you know, you walk in a room like this and you can see the impermanence. It was a building that was built as a warehouse. Look at these old brick walls. Someday it's going to fall down. Right now it's a zendo. You know, so she spent a year just looking at impermanence everywhere in her life. And you can do the same thing with qualities like compassion and equanimity and other kinds of qualities. So, you know, you're going through your day and you notice things like, well, that wasn't very compassionate, or now that thing that person just said, what a great show of compassion that was. Or what would the compassionate response have been right there? Or the other day I was with somebody and they said something and it just tripped my trigger and something came out of my mouth and immediately. So was that compassion, Miss Avalokiteshvara? I don't think so. You know? So, you know, you're just watching for it. You're watching for good examples of it. You're watching for bad examples of it. You're trying to get to a place where it kind of arises on its own without it having to be something mechanical that you're striving to do. So that's that. Through the day, great compassion. Through the night, great compassion. I think that's the actual practice of what you're doing. You know, you're making that kind of habit energy happen. And then the last two lines are Ninnin Jushin Ki Ninnin Furishin. And that's thought after thought arise in the mind. Thought after thought are not separate from mind. So thought after conscious thought after thought conscious thought arise in our mind. And, you know, we hear the bird and we just hear the bird. And then we have these thoughts about the bird. And then we go back to just listening to the bird. And then we scold ourselves for not being able to just listen to the bird, that we're always going off on something. And that's kind of what we do a lot, I think, when we're sitting, when we're doing zazen. You know, we have these thoughts that come up all the time. And if we're the kind of person who has that kind of thinky-thinky, kind of always thoughts arising mind, it can be kind of frustrating and aggravating, you know, like, I wasn't really sitting. All I was doing was thinking. But it's the, number one, it's the coming back to it. And also, when we're doing that, when we catch ourselves doing that, it's a really wonderful opportunity for a compassion practice. You know, sometimes when I just cannot stop ruminating about something, or when my mind is just going too much in zazen, I'll remind myself, okay, I'm going to dedicate this sitting to all the people in the world who are sitting right now with this kind of manic mind. Yeah. And my mind might still be kind of manic, but the compassion goes out to all those other people in the world, and somehow it's easier to feel compassion for them, but it's also, it reminds me that I'm not the only one, and it reminds me that I'm not separate. I'm not the only one who's sitting here doing this. That a lot of people do this. That this is sort of the human condition. And so it kind of turns that thinking a little bit and reminds me that that while there's thinking going on, there's still that sort of big M mind. You know, there's small M mind, little thinky mind, but then there's also that large, vast, spacious mind at the same time. And and the thoughts are arising out of that spacious mind, but they're not really other than that spacious mind. So, you know, imagine that the thrush comes and it sits on our hand. And while we're sitting here with this bird in our hand, and we're going, wow, this, you know, look at this. This bird just, it's a beautiful bird. Look at this bird. I can't believe it landed in my hand. And at the same time that we're doing that, we are feeling that kind of vibrant life of that little bird in our hand, right? Both at the same time. And on some level, there's a kind of genetic memory or something of our being an animal in the universe, or being in the universe with this other being in the universe right there. So at the same time that we're going, oh, pretty bird, we're also feeling the bird, and we're also just kind of deeply relating to the bird. And one of those feelings doesn't come out of another or arise out of another one. They're all just right there together. So that thought after thought, they arise in our mind, but they're not really separate from us. So that gives me great comfort, because I have one of those little thinky minds. And I think we need to remind ourselves sometimes that that's the nature of the mind. And it's not something other than the great mind of compassion. They're not separate. So, likewise, a person who takes up the practice of doing a chant like this is working on developing a kind of trust that compassion is already here. You know, that the egg has everything that it needs to become a bird, that the egg already is the bird, that the compassion is already here, that we may think that we are working on developing it, but we already are Kanzan, we already are that bodhisattva of compassion, even while we may not think we are. We may not believe we are. We may have to take other people's word for it for a while. But doing this kind of practice, I think one of the points of it is beginning to see that Kanzan isn't somebody other than you or me. It isn't something, compassion isn't something apart from us. And that it is possible to absorb those sounds of the world, to absorb the cries and the pains of the world, and awaken a Buddha right here on our cushion. Yeah. I think that's more than everything that I know about this chant. Does anybody have anything they want to talk about? Yeah, Jeff.
Kanzan, praise to Buddha, all are one with Buddha, all awake to Buddha. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. Through the day, Kanzan, through the night, Kanzan. This moment arises from mind. This moment itself is mine.
Ah, you know that one. It's a wonderful chant, isn't it? Thank you. Thank you.
That
Tonglen practice. Yeah. Yeah, I taught a class on Tonglen, boy, years ago, long time ago. It's a practice of receiving and sending compassion. It's a Tibetan practice of when you're meditating, on the in-breath, you're taking in the suffering of the world, and then and on the out-breath, you're sending back out the relief of the world, the relief of that suffering. So you're almost acting like kind of a filter, you know. You're breathing in the sorrow and the suffering, and you're breathing back out relief for it. And it's a wonderful practice. and the thing about it is that I'm agnostic on whether it changes anything in the world. You know, I mean, I don't know if you are thinking about, you know, someone that you know right now is suffering from cancer, and so you breathe in the suffering that they're feeling, and then you're breathing out the relief of good health, right? And I have, you know, I'm totally agnostic on whether that does anything for their illness, but what I do know is that it increases your capacity for compassion. So it's a wonderful, wonderful practice. So, somebody back there had something. Kathleen, yeah.
Oh, thanks, Rosemary.
Yeah.
Did you say you were alone in the bus with those two guys? There's nobody else in the bus?
There were a couple other people on the bus, but there were probably five or six people on the bus at that point, yeah. Yeah.
When you told that story, I had a lot of images in my mind and a lot of potential scenarios. And what I imagined was that you were alone in the bus and these two guys, and I just imagined them to be black, were behind you, and I thought, I wonder if they were trying to get your attention. I wonder if they were trying to intimidate you. wonder if you would have turned around and said, such an interesting song. Could I share with you that song? just several things. I thought, I wonder if she got up and just moved away if it would have stopped. But it was almost like a cross-cultural exchange. I was thinking, are they trying to get your attention and see what you would do?
Yeah.
Those were a lot of thoughts that came to my mind with that.
Yeah.
It was obvious that it was horrible and shocking.
Yeah, it was shocking.
To come back and not give the response that they may have hoped for, maybe they were hoping that you get up and leave and be that shocked.
Brave. You know, it didn't feel scary at the time. I've been intimidated by young men on the bus, doing that kind of thing, just trying to intimidate that, lady there, sitting there. But last night, I one of the wonderful things I got to tell you about being a middle-aged woman is that you are invisible. I just had no feeling that I was there, that they noticed I was there. So it's interesting. I didn't have a sense of self in that at all. I could just hear them. So it didn't feel scary, no. Yeah. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Yeah, Stephanie.
It's so funny. I haven't had the one thought that you expressed exactly the same way. I also thought of the cross-cultural experience. I was imagining, like you, that they were probably rapping. And I was wondering if you can rap Buddhism. Whether you could, because it, rather than countering what they're expressing, in a weaving, what you're expressing with their medium.
Mm. Yeah, they were going back and forth. I could have thrown in, I could have thrown in my own. But there's a guy in this is how much I know about current culture. But there's a group called the Beastie Boys, and one guy is Buddhist, and that's everything I know about that. There is a guy who does
rap. I think it's called Bodhisattva Vow.
Did he really?
Yeah.
See, there you go. There you go. All right. That's Ted's next talk. When's your next talk, Ted? So, yeah. You had something?
I guess I just wanted to briefly defend the gangster rap. Because it sort of is, but it's also a little bit, I think an art form that's a parody, it's recognizing a thing that exists.
Yeah.
And some of it is just a little over the top, where everything's people shooting around.
Yeah.
Some of it is a little bit like rapping about something that is not, it's trying to paint the horrible picture.
Yeah.
Show the horrible thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan and I were just.
To be completely staying automatically.
Yeah. Susan and I were just talking about that very thing this morning at breakfast, about this sort of a generational, there's a generational thing there, I think. Of because my kids tell me the same thing about vampire movies and things like that, is that they have a real different point of view about it than I do, and I recognize that there is a kind of
Rosemary, thanks for the story and your talk today. Your story about the bus made me think of something else. And I was sitting in a restaurant this week at a business meeting, and a man walking outside fell on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see it, but one of the people that I was in the meeting with saw it and commented on it. And I watched the man trying to get up off the ice, and then he was visibly shaken, and he had to walk past. We were on the ground floor, and he had to walk right past us. And I felt this intense desire to get up from my business meeting and go outside and comfort him.
Yeah.
But I didn't. And I felt intimidated by the other people at the business meeting that it would be inappropriate for me to have done that.
Uh-huh.
But your talk has made me realize that next time that happens, I have to act and not think about how somebody else would react to my compassion.
Yeah, yeah. Never be embarrassed to take the compassionate response. Who cares what they think? Well, of course, we care what they think. Otherwise, we
well,
do it.
Well, it happened to be they were getting my evaluation.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to downgrade you on your performance evaluation on the basis of your great compassion. You know, I worked in the business world for 20 years. I know what that would do to your performance evaluation. It would just go straight down. Karen works in HR. Tell us what that would do, Karen. So thank you. It's a good impulse, I think, you know? Yeah.
I think the thing on the bus, I think maybe what made a difference that you were at ease. You didn't take it personal. You thought of them, not of yourself. And it makes a whole difference in the world. I mean, people feel it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a good point.
You don't think about yourself. You feel, you know, you're being at ease. You're thinking about them. You're not scared. And people, even from your back, people would feel it.
Huh.
And it would make a huge difference.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe you were in the royal ease. You don't have to raise your knee to do that, right?
Yeah. Well, that'd be something. Sitting on the bus, you could...
People feel it even from the back and from the distance.
They do. There's a way that people feel that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You don't have to sit on that front part of the bus, you know, in full lotus. People kind of feel that. So somebody, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to thank you for something. When you talk about Zen meditation and how to understand that a busy mind is part of all reality and really accept it, so we maybe hope to it and cultivate a common mind that connects us with a bigger M. When you describe that, I'd like to thank you for the imagery that you gave me, because I all of a sudden thought of it as things happening simultaneously and coming from different sources simultaneously, and usually we don't see all sources or experience all sources, even though they're always there. And then maybe in meditation we can see almost like smoke of different colors coming out of different pots at the same time, where usually we just see one color, maybe two. But when we calm our mind, we see all of them happening, the chatty, the calm, and then the big mind is beyond ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all good. I mean, they're all something.
Yeah.
All happening at the same time.
Yeah, they're beyond our evaluation. We don't need to be saying, you know, this one's not so good.
Right. You know,
so
we let on one, we let it smoke.
Yeah.
But we see others.
Yeah. And we come back to our breath and let go of those thoughts. Yeah, which we're not. You know, it's. Yeah. MC Yogi, Yogi. Cool. You know, I'm sure there was. I don't know that these guys are rapping. They were reciting. It's just that they were reciting kind of horrifying things. So I am not anywhere cool enough to know anything about rapping. I have no idea. So Jenny, yeah.
Thanks for your talk, Courtney. I really your comment too about acting with compassion is difficult. You know, because from the unobserved, they ask you for money, and your first instinct, at least sometimes my first instinct, is to move back.
Yeah.
You know, to be afraid.
Yeah.
Because of that unknown. But I think this conversation also brings a lot about how compassionate our thoughts are. the perception that we have of people simply based on, really not actually not experience, but perhaps our own history, our own culture, our own stereotypes.
Mm.
And so the projections that we have, the thoughts that we have and the projections, and then maybe the actions that come from those thoughts and projections, also have a level of compassion for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're thinking kind of narrow, small lines in our thoughts or projections, or whether we're thinking big lines. And that, I think, also has a lot to do with compassion.
Yeah, and doing this kind of cultivation practice, even when the small mind, the narrow mind stuff comes up, we can pretty quickly snap over to the other one, almost effortlessly, and without getting too down on ourselves for, oh, my first thought was, what's the matter with you? And going right to that kind of bigger perspective. Which is one of the great things about it. I mean, I didn't become interested in compassion out of being a compassionate person. The first Buddhist talks that I heard about it, I didn't understand what they, it took me a long time to understand the difference between compassion and pity, and compassion and empathy, and it took me a long time to figure out what they meant by that. So I think that's why it's so interesting to me, because it didn't come naturally. Yeah. So, oh, we are getting close to 11 o'clock, aren't we? We have some announcements for you.